One of the most remarkable things one discovers in telling the history of debt is that the world, or at least the Eurasian continent, is far more connected than we ordinarily suppose. Up until roughly 600 BC, we can speak of an age of agrarian empires, where money was essentially credit, with transactions facilitated through a web of debts. Then came the classical period, which witnessed the invention of coinage in Greece, India, and China, ushering in an era where money was seen as a physical thing you held in your hand. This period lasted until roughly 600 years after the birth of Christ. The next era, the Middle Ages, which lasted approximately 800 years, saw coinage largely disappear and money become virtual once again. During this period, the great popular religious movements of the ancient world, Christianity and Islam in the West, Buddhism and Confucianism in the East, became the dominant force in society. Virtual money began to replace cash-based economies as power moved from a class of professional soldiers to one of professional clerics. Everywhere, religious authorities took over the management of the new credit systems, because during the Middle Ages, the economy did not, as textbooks have long assumed, revert to barter. What the Middle Ages really saw was the rise of an endless variety of credit arrangements. Dr. Christopher Briggs is a medieval historian at the University of Cambridge.
Interestingly enough, buying on credit isn't simply a modern phenomenon at all. It's actually the most widespread form of credit in the medieval period. It was actually much more common than a straightforward loan of cash, which we might think of as an important form of credit today also. A typical transaction would be a deferred payment, so you would buy a cow with agreement that 6 months down the line you would pay the 10 shillings purchase price.
During this period, actual gold and silver was cashed away in temples, monasteries, and other sacred places. Ordinary money became virtual again. In Europe, people continued using Roman money to keep accounts in, even though the actual physical currency no longer existed. Instead, people made their transactions using debased local coinage, leather tokens, or tally sticks. Christopher Briggs again.
Tally sticks are very interesting. They were short pieces of hazel wood, which served as a receipt for payment. And the short hazel stick, maybe 20 to 30 centimeters long, was notched in order to indicate the amount that had been paid. Then the stick would be split lengthways, and both the payer and the receiver would receive one half of the stick. And it constituted proof of payment. It acted as a receipt. And this was quite a convenient, sophisticated system. They were easy to store, and they were very hard to forge. So a tally stick could act as a receipt for money advanced, i.e. as a receipt for a loan, or as evidence of a debt, and could later be proffered in court if there was a dispute.
The Islamic world and the Indian subcontinent made use of various sorts of paper credit instruments. Checks were already in widespread use in everyday transactions in Basra in the 10th century AD. Now that money was no longer seen as a physical commodity, but as an understanding, a credit arrangement, which took material form in whatever shape the political authorities wanted, the critical thing was to prevent a return to the debt crises of antiquity, which would inevitably result if the credit system spun entirely out of control. And how do debts spiral out of control? The answer, of course, is through interest, which causes them to grow and grow. In order to combat this, the response of the major world religions was to ban usury. Dr. Abdullah Shaheen is a theologian at the Markfield Institute of Higher Education.
According to Islam, interest is absolutely banned. There are no two ways about this. And it's equivalent of declaring war on God, basically. Therefore, any earnings out of practice of usury is completely unacceptable, morally, religiously, or in fact economically. So it is seen as a form of exploitation and a form of really abusing the legitimate trade and exchange of commerce, basically. Because of its exploitative nature and its consequences for the whole well-being of the individuals and the communities.
In Christendom, interest-taking on loans was also outlawed entirely. In India, it was sharply limited. And in China, Confucian authorities renewed the old tradition of periodic debt cancellations, while Buddhist monasteries created pawn shops to provide impoverished peasants with an alternative to the local loan shark. The desire to protect ordinary people from debt traps didn't necessarily have any implications for religious attitudes towards commerce. Confucians and Christians were suspicious of merchants. Muslim and Buddhist thinkers were enthusiastic about them. Indeed, one of the more remarkable stories of the Middle Ages was the rise of the world's first genuine free market populism. It was a result of the peculiar alignment of social forces that came together with the mass conversion to Islam, 2 centuries after the original Arab conquests of the 6th century AD. Islamic law strictly forbade not only the lending of money at interest, but also debt peonage, or the reduction of believers into slavery. Merchants quickly became the moral pillars of communities now organized, as they still are, around the twin poles of bazaar and mosque. Government itself came to be largely despised by the pious.
Only the best princes are those who visit religious teachers,
one proverb put it.
Only the worst religious teachers are those who allow themselves to be visited by princes.
A medieval Turkish story about the famous Sufi sage, the Mullah Nasruddin, brings home this even more pointedly.
The king once summoned Nasruddin to court. "Tell me," said the king, "you are a mystic, a philosopher, a man of unconventional understandings. I have become interested in the issue of value. It's an interesting philosophical question. How does one establish the true worth of a person or an object? Take me, for example. If I were to ask you to estimate my value, what would you say?" "Oh," Nasruddin said, "I'd say about 200 dinars. The emperor was flabbergasted. "What? But this belt I'm wearing is worth 200 dinars. "I know," said Nasruddin. "Actually, I was taking the value of the belt into consideration."
During this period, letters of credit could circulate from Mali to Sumatra, far beyond the reach of any government, and entirely based on personal honor, since for a merchant operating without the ability to call on the state to enforce contracts, personal honor was everything. Muhammad himself had spent much of his life as a merchant, and as a result, he exhibited a surprisingly liberal attitude toward market regulation. Dr. Abdullah Shaheen again.
Clearly, a kind of a liberal attitude, if I may put it in that way, is visible in the early Islamic attitude towards market. There was a trust in the market that it will work it out its own way. And as the Prophet says, God's hand basically is the determinant here. It will kind of regulate. This prophetic attitude towards allowing the market to naturally work it out itself is remarkable because it has been expressed by Adam Smith in his famous analogy of invisible hand will actually tame the selfish interest and the competitive spirit of the individuals who want to make more money. It will be somehow tamed with ending up with the common good.
Many of Adam Smith's theories, even some of his most famous figures of speech, have now been shown to derive from free market theorists in medieval Islam. There is one dramatic difference, though. Like Smith, Islamic thinkers stressed that the division of labor and resultant systems of market exchange were the key to human prosperity. Unlike him, they did not stress the role of competition, which they considered to be a necessary element, but by no means the essence of the market. Rather, the market was an extension of the principle of mutual aid, as the medieval Islamic scholar Tusi explains.
"Let us suppose that each individual were required to busy himself with providing his own sustenance, clothing, dwelling place, and weapons, first acquiring the tools of carpentry and the smith's trade, then readying thereby tools and implements for sowing and reaping, grinding and kneading, spinning and weaving. Clearly he would not be capable of doing justice to any one of them. But when men render aid to each other, each one performing one of these important tasks that are beyond the measure of his own capacity, and observing the law of justice in transactions by giving greatly and receiving in exchange of the labour of others, then the means of livelihood are realised, and the succession of the individual and the survival of the species are assured."
As a result, Tusi argues, divine providence has arranged us to have different abilities, desires, and inclinations. The market is simply one manifestation of this more general principle of mutual aid, of the matching of abilities, supply, and needs, demand. Or, to translate it into my own terms, it is not only founded on, but is itself an extension of, what I have called baseline communism. From each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. The reason is simple. Whatever the origin of money in market systems, and as we've seen, they were at every stage entangled in war and violence, once market relations are set free from this, or from any form of state enforcement, they take on an entirely different character. To put it starkly, one cannot have cutthroat competition where there's no one stopping you from actually cutting one another's throats. One can look to profit, but ultimately one's reputation for honor and integrity, of always paying one's debts, but also taking the means and situation of the other party into consideration, was the key to a successful enterprise in the world trading economy created by medieval Islam. The entire economic system during this era was based principally on credit. However, after around 1450, the pendulum began to swing back again towards a period of physical money. Huge amounts of gold and silver bullion soon began to flow across the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, laying the foundations for what we have come to know as the world economy. The entire process was driven by debt. While we are used to thinking of all this as having begun with Columbus's journeys and the Spanish conquest of the Americas, the chain of events that led to the birth of the bullion-based world system actually began in China under the Ming Dynasty in the 14th century. For centuries, China had been the most prosperous, technologically advanced, but also most politically unruly corner of the Eurasian continent. Many of the most famous dynasties were created by peasant revolts. The Ming Dynasty itself came to power in 1368 as a popular insurrection against China's Mongol overlords, the Yuan, but it soon found itself embroiled in an ongoing crisis over the old Mongol monetary system. The Mongols used a system of paper money, which suffered from chronic inflation. It was also tied to a particularly obnoxious system that slotted everyone into permanent caste-like roles, farmers, artisans, or soldiers. When the Ming did not immediately abolish it, millions of people began simply ignoring the system, creating an alternative economy of illegal commerce based on uncoined silver money. Hilda de Wiert is a professor of Chinese history at Leiden University.
The Ming had established a paper currency system and quickly ran into the same sorts of problems that the Mongols had run into when establishing paper currency as well. They outlawed the use of silver in transactions and also in tax payments, but over time, the court gives in. They recognize that these policies are not successful, that they cannot encourage people to trust paper currency. And how could they, given it was clear to everybody that inflation was not under control. And so eventually, they give in. They allow for silver to be used in transactions. They also allow for cash to be used by local people on a daily basis. And gradually, paper currency begins to disappear from the scene.
The Ming soon found there was a problem. The Chinese mines turned out not to have much silver in them, and the new economic system created an insatiable demand for precious metal. It was in the government's interest to import as much as possible to keep taxes low and prevent further revolt. Hilda de Wiert again.
The only reason why silver was able to become the new standard in 15th century China had to do with new inflows of silver. There weren't enough silver mines in China to satisfy the demand of an expanding, a rapidly expanding economy. So initially, lots of silver was imported from Japan. A second and far more important inflow of silver came from the Americas. From the 1570s in particular, after Manila had been set up as a major headquarters. Silver flowed in from Mexico and Peru into Manila, and from there predominantly to China. And here the scale is, by all indications, enormous. So we're talking initially about tens of thousands of kilograms and later hundreds of thousands by the 1620s. The amounts of silver flowing into China on an annual basis are skyrocketing. Most likely, the colonies would not have been viable had it not been for the demand of silver in 16th and 17th century China.
But the mere existence of a demand for silver in China doesn't itself explain why the colonizers of the Americas were willing to do absolutely anything to fulfill it. To understand the creation of the world economic system that later came to be known as capitalism, one has to, first of all, understand what motivated the conquistadors, and their later imitators, to pursue economic advantage at the expense of any other possible motivation. China itself had its own age of exploration a half century before, but it never seemed to occur to them to conquer, seize control of, and devastate whole nations simply to extract from those countries the maximum amount of useful resources. If one reads accounts of the immediate results of the conquest of Peru or Mexico, one encounters scenes of human cruelty, of the systematic destruction of human societies, so extreme it's hard to imagine how human beings could be capable of inflicting such things on one another. Here is a description the Franciscan missionary Fray Toribio de Motolinha wrote of the 10 plagues that he believed God had visited upon the inhabitants of Mexico.
The heavily laden Indians traveled 60 leagues or more to carry provisions. When their food gave out, they died, either at the mines or on the road, for they had no money to buy food, and there was no one to give it to them. Some reached home in such a state that they died soon after. The bodies of those Indians and of the slaves who died in the mines produced such a stench that it caused a pestilence, especially at the mines of Oaxaca. For half a league around these mines and along a great part of the road, one could scarcely avoid walking over dead bodies or bones. And the flocks of birds and crows that came to fatten themselves upon the corpses were so numerous that they darkened the sun.
The conquistadors are remembered today as a kind of apotheosis of human greed. We seem to be speaking here not just of simple greed, but greed raised to mythic proportions. Their insatiable appetite for plunder was, in fact, fueled by debt. Matthew Restall is a professor of Latin American history at Penn State University.
You could look at the entire history of conquest in the mainland Americas through the lens of debt, because there was a kind of debt logic that was built into the chains of conquest. As those chains extended, they were financed and made possible by previous discoveries and also by the promise of future discoveries. So there's a complex debt and credit system that is imported from Spain into the Caribbean and then continues to grow, and the logic of it is continued expansion, and that is almost a sort of a platitude of empires generally, that empires have an expansive logic built into them that obliges them to continue to expand. Otherwise, they kind of collapse inward, that they can't remain static. And that is certainly true of the Spanish Empire in the 16th century.
Hernán Cortés, the conqueror of Mexico, was also motivated by debt. Cortés had been living beyond his means and got himself into considerable financial difficulty. He decided, like a reckless gambler, to double down and go for broke by launching a mission to establish a Spanish presence on the mainland. He set sail with 600 men, offering each an equal share in the expedition's profits. 3 years later, through some of the most ingenious, ruthless, brilliant, and utterly dishonorable behavior by a military leader ever recorded, Cortés had his victory. The Aztec treasury was secured, and the time had come for it to be divided amongst the surviving soldiers. Cortés, however, had other plans. Matthew Restall again.
When it came time to parceling out privileges at the end of the war, there was a great deal of corruption. the material wealth that was promised, particularly mineral wealth, gold and silver that was promised by Cortes and the leaders, did not materialize or disappeared. Spanish officials came in after the conquest and often passed over individuals who had fought in the conquest wars and were laying claim to these riches.
Cortes even insisted that the men be billed for any replacement equipment and medical care that they had received during the war. Most actually ended up in debt due to the campaign. According to Bernal Diaz del Castillo, who accompanied Cortes during the conquest, the result among the men was outrage.
"We were all very deeply in debt. A crossbow was not to be purchased for less than 40 or 50 pesos. A musket cost 100, a sword 50, and a horse from 800 to 1,000 pesos and above. Thus extravagantly did we have to pay for everything. A surgeon, who called himself Master Juan, who had tended some very bad wounds, charged wildly inflated fees."
These angry, debt-laden men fanned out across Latin America, establishing local administrations, taxes, and labor regimes, always looking to relieve their debt burden by exploiting the local population. This makes it a little easier to understand the descriptions of the mines surrounded by miles of rotting corpses. We're not dealing with a psychology of cold, calculating greed, but of a much more complicated mix of shame, righteous indignation, and of the frantic urgency of debts that would only compound and accumulate. The conquistadors offer us a prime example of the horror that can result when debt is allowed to grow unchecked. Yet that fundamental, constitutive relation between, on the one hand, the creditor or investor, guaranteed a fixed rate of profit, and the adventurous debtor, one who goes to distant places in search of profit, willing to calculate and carry out whatever it takes to pay back the beast looming over his shoulder, remains the unique basis for the economy that began to be built within the new global market. It's still here, in the form of investors and executives and corporations, the corporate form itself being originally designed to pursue just such colonial adventures. As we shall see, it remains with us, and has, in every way, transformed the world around us. The history of the Eurasian continent has oscillated back and forth between eras of virtual money, where people conducted transactions using credit arrangements rather than cash, and periods where people did business using physical money, coins. We've been in one such period since the 1450s. Most of us are absolutely convinced that money is a thing. In this most recent era of coinage, which lasted roughly 500 years, debts and credit continued to be used, but came to be seen not just as social arrangements, but absolute imperatives that could not simply be cancelled out or readjusted as occasion demanded. So, what was this era like? In many ways, it marked a return to the classical age. It saw not only the return of bullion, but of empires, standing armies, even of chattel slavery. This is the great paradox of the era, as it was also marked by dazzlingly rapid technological change.
The spinning jenny.
Steamships.
Railroads.
The telephone.
Circuit boards.
The conventional view of the birth of capitalism is that the innovations of the period led to greater material prosperity, enabling us to lead happier lives. While this is not entirely untrue, these times were also marked by extraordinary levels of war and violence. This was also an era in which money came to be seen as a physical thing, and debts had to be repaid. The enormous productivity of the era was only made possible by the existence of extraordinary mechanisms designed to pump out more and more disciplined labor. The history of the Atlantic slave trade is a perfect example, and debt underpinned the entire process. Initially, slaves were captured during violent raids. The raids were eventually routinized, using a complex network of credit arrangements. In the late 17th century, ship owners based in Liverpool or Bristol would acquire goods such as copper wires and brass rods on easy credit terms from local wholesalers, expecting to make good by selling slaves, also on credit, to plantation owners in the Antilles and North America. Ship owners would then transport their wares to African ports like Ouidah, Bonny, or Calabar, The goods were then advanced to African merchants, again on credit, and those African merchants would pay back what they owed in slaves. The merchants would lure local rulers into debt traps, which obliged them to turn their entire criminal justice system into a giant engine to extract slaves. Or they would collude with the rulers to trap their subjects in debt, forcing many of them to sell their own dependents, servants, children, wives, even, finally, themselves, into slavery. The Tiv, a Nigerian people who spent much of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries trying to insulate themselves from the slave trade devastating nearby communities, created a kind of nightmare fantasy version of what was happening in their notion of the flesh debt. According to the legend, the Tiv were haunted by a secret society of cannibalistic witches who would slip bits of human flesh into innocent neighbors' food. The following is a reading from Tiv historian Akiga Sai.
Perhaps your friend, or some older man, has noticed that you have a large number of children, or brothers and sisters, and so tricks you into contracting the debt with him. He invites you to eat food in his house alone with him, and when you begin the meal, he sets before you two dishes of sauce, one of which contains cooked human flesh. Once you have eaten, the society of witches will come to you at night and announce that you have to pay off the debt you have inadvertently contracted by killing off members of your own family to turn them over for the witches to consume. The flesh debt goes on and on. The creditor keeps on coming.
This is just a magical version of something that was really happening to millions of Africans who ended up being ripped from their families by debt contracts and sent off to be literally worked to death. The Atlantic slave trade was, like the destruction of the Americas, an unprecedented catastrophe. But it just reveals in spectacular form the subtle logic underlying most of the new forms of labor extraction that emerged over the course of the 16th to 19th centuries. We tend to see this process as a sideshow during the rise of capitalism, which to our collective mind began with the rise of smokestack industries full of clock-punching wage laborers. But capitalism was, in fact, first founded on colonial and military ventures, driven by debt and tribute during the heyday of the slave trade. The factories came later. This becomes all the more apparent if we look at how those forms of money and credit unique to capitalism first came into being. There is no question that capitalism has been uniquely innovative in this regard, but most of these financial innovations, whether stock markets, bond markets, limited liability corporations, or central banking systems, emerged long before the factory system, or even before the widespread practice of wage labor. Instead, they emerged in the context of military commercial colonial ventures of one sort or another, like the Dutch or British East India corporations. The word capitalist itself was, until the 19th century, largely used to refer to holders of government bonds, the issuance of which was pioneered in Italian city-states like Venice or Genoa, which, among other things, sold shares in military expeditions to be paid off with a proportional share of any resultant loot. For the wealthy, the investing classes, the main form of money was not actually gold or silver, but various forms of interest-bearing government debt, called variously rentes, juros, or annuities, which were ultimately government war debts. The culmination of this process was the founding of the Bank of England. It was created in 1694, more than half a century before the first stirrings of the Industrial Revolution. Keith Hart is a professor of economic anthropology at the London School of Economics.
There is a hidden story of money and power in our societies over the last 400 years at least, which is that the politicians need money. You know, the king needs to pay for his wars, and the money men need political and legal cover. So the money men and the politicians have to make some kind of deal. And the first deal of its kind that could be described as a central bank was the formation of the Bank of England after King William had essentially won the 30 Years' War. King William wanted the money to pay off his war debts, and he acquired a bunch of private bankers. And the question is, what is he going to offer them in exchange for them paying off his debts. And what he offered them was a banking monopoly, the monopoly of the management of the national debt, which was essentially the king's debt.
Since the foundation of the Bank of England, the first independent national central bank, money has been essentially circulating government debt. I'm going to take a £5 note out of my pocket. It bears a picture of the Queen, but more importantly, it has a promise written on it.
I promise to pay the bearer, on demand, the sum of £5.
This note in my hand is not itself £5. It is the monarch's promise to pay £5, which can, for that reason, be used to cancel out the debt you owe to the monarch in the form of taxes, and by extension, as U.S. currency says legally, to pay all debts, public and private. For this reason, that original loan from the bankers to King William can never be repaid. Were the Queen to pay the debt today, the entire British currency system would effectively disappear. This, then, explains why it is that all modern nation-states run by deficit finance and maintain a national debt. There has to be a debt, because money, now, essentially is government debt. What did all this mean for ordinary villagers and townsfolk back in 1694 when the Bank of England was founded? It's critical to bear in mind that in early modern times, ordinary Britons rarely had occasion to touch real physical money at all. For them, money still took the form of debt and credit. Dr. Craig Muldrew is an early modern historian at the University of Cambridge.
In the early modern period, credit is normative. Almost all the transactions, I would say, over 90% are done on credit, simply because there isn't enough cash to go around and the quality of the coins is very variable.
Debt was, in its own way, the soul of society. A man's credit was his honor, and it was only right and proper that everyone in a community should be at least a little bit indebted to everyone else.
The webs of credit stretched all around the country, located and intersecting largely in villages and larger towns. So, for instance, a baker will be baking and selling bread every day. A shoemaker will be making shoes. Obviously, the shoemaker needs bread every day. The baker might need 4 or 5 pairs of shoes a year. So probably at the end of 6 months or a year, they would get together and reckon or cancel the debts, and that could create a new debt. So in that way, you can see how credit and debt can all be entangled within these webs.
Slowly but steadily, these village credit systems began to fade away as the government embarked upon the long and technologically difficult process of trying to create the millions of pieces of small change that would make it possible for everyday transactions to be carried out in cash. Gradually, the ideology of money as an absolute value emerged, and the idea that debts could be written off became a thing of the past. The increasingly punitive nature of the laws meant that debtors could, if their creditor was sufficiently vindictive, end up behind bars. For the rich, a spell in debtor's prison became something of a fashion statement. For ordinary debtors, it was often a sentence of death. The result was that the informal credit systems, which had long defined communal existence for English villagers and townsfolk, were gradually destroyed, and what had been considered the very substance of human sociality came to be treated as a crime. Much of the chaos of our current era seems to stem from the fact that, since the 1970s, we've been coming out of this period of physical money, which began in the early modern period. But we are still looking at economic problems in terms appropriate to what is, in fact, rapidly becoming a bygone age. In 1971, the world economy entered a new era when Nixon abandoned the gold standard.
In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
By stating that the dollar was no longer redeemable in gold, Nixon kickstarted a process by which money has become a virtual commodity rather than a physical thing that you hold in your hands. This was the first of what looks very much like a cascade of related processes, from the birth of plastic and everyday transactions to the rise of the financial system, in which people make money from money, where vast profits materialize, with no need for engagement with production in the physical world. Anne Pettifor is an economist and a director of the think tank Policy Research and Macroeconomics.
There are two ways of making money. You can invest in a project, engage with the land in the broadest sense of the word, grow tomatoes, say, and engage with labor to ensure those tomatoes are fed and watered and marketed and so on and so forth. That's one kind of activity at which capitalists can make profits. There's another way to make money, and that is to speculate, to gamble. And speculation does not require engagement with the land or with labor, but the returns can be exponential.
In the context of the history of debt that we've been considering in this series, it's clear what's happening here. We are entering an age of virtual money. But this is not some entirely new, unprecedented phenomena made possible by the advent of computers. What we're seeing is yet another turn of the age-old oscillation between ages dominated by credit money, where people pay for things without the use of cash, and ages dominated by physical coinage, cash passing from hand to hand. Ordinarily, periods dominated by virtual credit money have also seen the creation of overarching mechanisms of some sort or another, designed to protect debtors from creditors, so the whole system does not descend into continual social crisis. It's easy to see why this should be. Where money is understood not to be a thing, but a promise, there has to be some sort of mechanism to prevent those with the means to create credit from simply enslaving everybody else, hence the ancient Middle Eastern jubilees and debt cancellations, or the medieval bans on interest-taking and debt peonage. Seen in this light, Greece's recent attempts to renegotiate their debt makes perfect historical sense. As the indignant reaction to Greece's suggestion shows, however, what we've actually seen over the last half century is exactly the opposite. The Western powers, spearheaded by America, have overseen the creation or reinforcing of great overarching mechanisms tasked with protecting creditors. The first of these global debt enforcers was the International Monetary Fund. Anne Pettifor again.
The IMF acts as gatekeeper to the international capital markets. In order to be able to borrow on international capital markets, countries have to satisfy the gatekeepers, the IMF, have to meet certain conditions. International creditors don't want to have to take the risk themselves of ensuring that Brazil or Rwanda or Argentina will repay. They have an agent, which is the IMF, that makes certain that that's going to happen. Now, the IMF does that by enforcing economic policies on governments which ensure that it earns the revenues needed in dollars to repay debts. And that is by reorienting their economies away from domestic interests towards the interests of foreign creditors by exporting mainly. And so we have a glut of exports, if you like, from all of these poor countries desperately trying to earn dollars to repay their creditors.
The results are that we have seen 40 years of continual social catastrophe, precisely the kind that the jubilees and debt cancellations of the past were designed to avoid. Over the course of the 1970s, Western banks began aggressively peddling loans to then largely dictatorial third world regimes. Much of this money was notoriously wasted, squandered, or deposited directly into the Swiss bank accounts of military strongmen and their cronies. In other times, it might have been possible to write off the huge debts incurred with a jubilee or institutionalized debt cancellation. In the 1980s and 90s, however, the third world nations were forced to foot the bill for the actions of their former rulers. When most of these countries gradually began to democratize, newly elected governments found themselves largely unable to dictate their own economic policy because Western powers, led by the U.S. Treasury and strongly backed by the IMF, insisted that all of these loans had to be fully repaid at floating interest rates. And since most were in no condition to do so, they would only allow them to be refinanced if the countries in question were willing to accept what were called structural adjustment policies at home. And Pettifor again.
Having been persuaded to take on these foreign loans, when they fell into debt and found it was hard to repay, the IMF moved into town and said, right, this is what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to privatize all your assets, your public assets. You're going to have to cut public spending and make sure that everything is aimed at repaying these debts. And this is a form of colonization. It's recolonization, but in a much more sophisticated form. After that, what you find is that there isn't a finance ministry anywhere in Africa which doesn't have within it IMF staff, that doesn't have within it an IMF-trained finance minister whose interests are aimed at Washington and who do nothing except keep the masters of the financial system happy and who do not respond to the interests of their people domestically.
It was the outrage such policies created that led to the rise of the global justice movement in the late 1990s and the first years of the current millennium.
For almost 2 hours, anti-capitalist demonstrators confronted lines of Swiss riot police.
Anti-globalisation's apparently emerged from nowhere in recent years.
We're asking for full-scale reform of the City of London, the corporation and its institutions.
Beginning with popular uprisings against austerity policies and gradually galvanising into a planetary network of popular movements, ranging from indigenous groups to radical labor unions to outright anarchists, and coordinated largely over the internet, the movement aimed first and foremost to expose the global bureaucratic structure that enforced debt arrangements, and second of all, to emphasize the degree to which this structure made any form of democratic self-governance impossible. Whilst ridiculed in the press, the global justice movement is not just a bunch of hardline leftist romantics. They should, in fact, be seen as a modern incarnation of the peasant revolts that have always accompanied debt crises throughout history. The movement was, in fact, startlingly successful. One need only look at the fate of the International Monetary Fund itself, the world's great debt enforcer. The real breaking point came in 2002, at the height of the global mobilization, when the economy of Argentina, hitherto the IMF's star pupil in Latin America, crashed, leading to battles in the streets, the overthrow of three governments in a row, road blockades, popular assemblies, and occupied factories. Ultimately, this led to Argentina doing something unprecedented. In what was, at the time, the greatest default in financial history, they unilaterally wrote down their debt to private lenders by 75 cents on the dollar. The banks appealed to the IMF, their accustomed enforcer, to apply the usual punishment. But for the first time in its history, the IMF had run out of options. With Argentina's economy already in ruins, even the economic equivalent of a nuclear bomb would do little more than to make the rubble bounce. The moment one regime was allowed to get away with it, however, everything changed. Other countries were quick to respond, realizing that it was time to cut ties with the IMF. And Pettifor again.
Many other debtor countries learnt a bitter lesson from that, which was that the IMF's policies were deeply flawed and inimical to the interests of their own people. And they began to get out. Brazil paid off her debts, tried to get out from under. Nigeria settled a deal with the IMF, got out from underneath the IMF. And the IMF was beginning to lose its raison d'etre of being, if you like, the world's gatekeeper to financial markets, and was luckily, from the point of view of IMF staff, rescued by the financial crisis when it was brought in by the ECB and by the Eurozone countries to help manage the crisis in Greece and so on. But it was very close to losing the reason for its existence.
on the verge of collapse, the IMF was saved, offered a new lease of life as the imposer of austerity in Europe following the financial crash of 2008. The crash may be over, but the debt crisis remains, due to the fact that we are continuing to apply tools appropriate to an age of bullion and cash, to one that is rapidly becoming an age of credit and virtual money. We think of the arrival of contactless payments, credit cards, PayPal, as terribly modern. In fact, there have been many eras of virtual money over the past 5,000 years. We cannot yet know what this latest phase will mean. We're perhaps 40 years into an historical epoch. It's likely to last 500. To put the matter in perspective, capitalism as an economic system has existed entirely within one turn of the oscillation back and forth between physical and virtual money. There's every reason to believe that if we are indeed heading towards a long epoch dominated by virtual money, the predominant economic system in this period, too, might be something different. As yet, we have no way of knowing what that system will be. But this does not mean events are predetermined. In fact, quite the opposite may be true. It's possible that we're living at just the sort of moment of great historical transformation where what we do makes the most difference. To conclude this series, I thought I would examine recent events, particularly the financial crash of 2008 and the European austerity crisis, and see how they look from the perspective of the long history of debt. What this history reveals, first of all, is that debts come to have very different moral status, depending on the power relations between debtor and creditor. Michael Hudson is a professor of economics at the University of Missouri.
Debts between equals rarely involve interest payments. If you're borrowing from a bank, that's a stranger, and you have to pay interest for that. A debt between equal, usually if you don't pay the debt or if you delay paying the debt, the equal is not going to come and say, okay, you have to give me your property. You're not going to try to squeeze another person into poverty in order to repay because you're equals and there's a kind of mutual self-support and mutual aid there. Only the banks or parties in power can enforce payment of the debts.
When the creditor has all the power, the repayment of debt becomes a sacrosanct principle, and writing it off becomes inconceivable. The events of 2008 provide us with a perfect example.
Share prices in one of Britain's biggest mortgage lenders, Northern Rock, have fallen sharply this morning after it was forced to seek an emergency loan from the Bank of England.
In the next few minutes, we're expecting to hear that the troubled bank Northern Rock will be nationalised.
Within the past hour, the American bank Lehman Brothers has collapsed.
The face of British banking has changed beyond recognition.
The story of the crash has been told many times. It involved large financial institutions lending money for mortgages that were in many cases designed to fail, and then taking bets with one another on how long it would take the borrowers to default. Everyone was in on the deal, from the government regulators that looked the other way to the credit agencies that gave such designed-to-fail securities AAA ratings. Once the crash came, hundreds of thousands of citizens found themselves underwater, with debt on their homes far higher than the actual value of the home itself, and almost all major financial institutions themselves were poised to crash, since the loans they had been claiming as assets proved valueless. Governments had effectively two options. They could print money to bail out the mortgage holders, which would then indirectly bail out the banks as well. Or they could refuse debt relief and simply give the money directly to the banks. In every case except Iceland, governments chose the latter. In England and Ireland, banks were going under as a result of fraud, and yet bankers and holders of stocks and bonds were in one way or another bailed out, even if it meant making billions of pounds worth of debt disappear through taxpayer-funded injections of cash or a baffling sequence of financial manipulations. For small-scale debtors, in contrast, paying back at agreed rates of interest, no matter what the circumstances, was considered a matter of simple morality. They'd borrowed the money. Of course they had to pay it back. Another thing we have learned over the course of this series is that debt is always surrounded by moral contradictions. Nowhere is this clearer than in the way we speak of national budgets.
We'll cut the deficit with the different kind of economy we need for working people.
You can't create the most important thing of all, which is growth, without first dealing with deficit. There's nothing pro-growth about having this dead weight of debt around our necks.
In normal times, the government should aim to run an overall budget surplus each and every year.
Ever since the creation of modern central banking systems at the end of the 17th century, all governments have maintained a national debt, and all politicians have spoken as if they really shouldn't have one. They all argue that we should balance our books, and that the national debt should ultimately be repaid. In fact, on the few occasions where governments have achieved a budget surplus and begun to pay back a significant portion of their national debt, the results have invariably been disastrous. It's easy enough to see why this should be. As we've seen from the example of the founding of the Bank of England, modern money is really just a collection of circulating IOUs. Governments create money by borrowing from banks, and banks issue IOUs. These IOUs are what we call money. If there were no national debt, governments wouldn't have to borrow from banks, and banks would have to create all the money themselves through private loans. But there simply aren't enough private borrowers. As a result, if the government stopped borrowing money, the money supply itself would collapse. This is why, for example, when Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan discussed a projected budget surplus in the U.S. in the 1990s, he made it clear that the result would be catastrophe.
More than half a trillion extra dollars would flow into Uncle Sam's coffers each year. As I contemplated this prospect, I felt a bit stunned. $500 billion is an almost unimaginable accumulation. What would the Treasury do with all that money? Where would it invest?
Of course, Greenspan was unwilling to say that the debt was necessary to maintain the money supply. So he instead insisted that a budget surplus would lead to socialism, since the government would inevitably use it to begin buying up assets like medical companies or the auto industry. It's hard to hear such scare stories without coming to the conclusion that governments and politicians recognize the absolute moral power of debt and do not wish to compromise it, as they would if they were to admit what debt actually was, a set of constantly renegotiable promises that are not a matter of essential moral turpitude on the part of governments or individuals, but the very basis of the monetary system. The need to maintain this principle is all the more crucial because the profits that drive Wall Street and the city, the largest and most powerful corporations, are actually ever more dependent on creating and maintaining mass indebtedness. Thomas Skokie is an artist and a member of Strike Debt, a protest movement which anonymously buys up debt, only to write it off entirely.
Financial corporations don't actually make money when they are making a loan that somebody can afford to pay. Credit card companies refer to people who pay off the balance on their credit card every month as deadbeats because they're not making money off of them. Instead, their real cash cow are people who struggle to pay the debt. They can add on late fees and late charges and all kinds of other hosts of fees, jack up the interest rates, et cetera. Those are the people who they're really profiting off of.
We're moving into a genuinely new economic era, one in which the very nature of profit, the role of government and force in maintaining the system, has begun to change. So far, these policies have systematically favored creditors over debtors. However, if history shows us anything, it's that such a system is not viable over the long term. The near collapse of the credit system in 2008, the endless debt crises that swept the planet since, and the new social movements they sparked, suggest that it's already facing serious challenges. The foundering of U.S. military power across the world is being met by, still confused, challenges to U.S. financial power. We cannot know for sure what direction all this will take, but there are clear signs of an imminent break. So, what hope is there for the future? Thomas Skokie.
It's really up to us what comes next. If all of us decide that the debts we owe the 1% are illegitimate and we're going to refuse to pay them, suddenly all kinds of resources get freed up that we can redirect towards what we consider to be our true obligations to one another. Somewhere between 25 and 50% of our income goes to pay illegitimate debts, debts owed to financial profiteers.
The new social movements, rallying against our powerful creditors, are an inevitable outcome of the fact that we no longer have institutionalized debt forgiveness of the kind we see in the ancient and medieval worlds. The Greek government's clash with the EU's financial institutions can be seen in the same light. So, what if we started to resist debt today? Thomas Gokey again.
Debt resistance isn't just a way of saying no to a system that we don't want. It frees up all kinds of creative potential and resources towards building the kind of society that we do want. This gets me really excited. In a lot of ways, we're in uncharted territory, but in a lot of ways, it means that if we are willing to organize and we're willing to work hard and we're willing to sacrifice, we can actually create the society we want to live in.
In the end, what is a debt? It's simply a promise. And what is society itself but a series of promises that we make to one another? Surely, if democracy is to mean anything here, it would mean that everyone has equal say in what sort of promises we make as a society, how we weigh them against one another, and when circumstances change, which have to be honored and which can be renegotiated. At the moment, these matters are regulated simply by power, dressed up in a mantle of morality. But the current historical shift to new forms of virtual credit money is making it increasingly difficult to disguise this fact. It's becoming increasingly apparent that we do not all have to pay our debts. Only some of us do. It may well be that future historians will see the age we currently live in as the first stirrings of a new system that will only fully emerge in years to come.